My name is Judy Madison. People sometimes think they have to call me Judith, but I answer to both. And this session is called Poet's Journey, Life is Good, Life is Hard. And I think the subtitle is a reflection of how I'm feeling now and have felt most particularly this last year. And so maybe we'll draw from that center post the most, Life is Good, Life is Hard. Let me read a little bit from Ecclesiastes. For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born, and a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build up, a time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek, and a time to lose, a time to keep, and a time to cast away, a time to rend, and a time to sow, a time to keep silence, and a time to speak, a time to love, and a time to hate, a time for war, and a time for peace. In my life story, I have over and over again come to a place where things have finally gotten better after some turmoil, some struggle. And then I think to myself with a deep sigh, now everything's going to be fine. I suppose that's the eternal hope of the human creature, but it's also so unrealistic that everything will now be smooth forever. It just doesn't work that way. And I like Ecclesiastes. There are a lot of things about Ecclesiastes I don't like, but that, I like that part of it because it shows us that rhythm, the ebb and flow of life, just as we see in the church seasons, an ebb and flow. There's Lent, which must be meditative before one can really appreciate the celebration of Easter, that kind of ebb and flow to life. So as I share with you today, I'm going to be sharing from things I have written. And they cover now we're at 20 years since that first book was published. I can hardly believe it. Now I'm struggling with turning 50. That's this year's struggle. But it's consolation that at least I have this, all these words to show that I've been somewhere in those 50 years. And so the first book called From a Woman's Heart starts with my youth and childhood and talks about my mother. Mother had a very lovely face, a quiet voice. Her skin was somehow softer to my touch than any other. Suddenly tonight I see it. She was kind. Her eyes were gentle, and her smile, how I did love to feel her smile upon me. She was comfort. I believe she really cared about me. Tonight she seemed so very present. She was too young to have died. Through my tears tonight, I miss my mother. As with all relationships, that was a mixed relationship. And there were things that I've come to know in later years that are greatly disappointing about mother. But she was, at some crucial times, there for me, and close enough anyway, that I received some nurture. She died when she was 42, and I really understand that now that I'm 8 years older. Well, how young she really was, and she died from Hodgkin's disease. And I was 18 at that time, and as the oldest child, took on all kinds of responsibilities. But I did have two grandmothers still living, and they lived until 1980, both of them. And so that meant that I had them quite a long time. They were very different people, but they were important in giving me some sort of security. The women in my life have been very important. Grandma Nelson was warm, kind of literally warm, and round, and soft. And she lived a kind of comfortable life. Grandma Gina, the Norwegian, was realistic and clever in the way she could sew, and she loved plants and the earth. She had common sense. So I had those two different kinds of people, Grandma Nelson. When I was a little girl, Grandma played piano and we sang. We sang of waves and nightcaps and of little birds and God. Yesterday I held my grandma's hand. It is soft and vibrant, though she just turned 82. Yesterday we talked together of the mystery of life and dying. Grandma knows that she will die. She's glad for her long life. But she says that somehow there's still so much to do. She squeezed my hand. She knows I love her, and that someday I will miss her so. But because of Grandma, I have memories which sing of waves and nightcaps, little birds, and God. And every little wave had a nightcap on, a nightcap, white cap, nightcap on. Every little wavelet had a nightcap on, so very, very early in the morning. She lived till she was 93. My home, however, was very highly dysfunctional. Part of that dysfunction was alcohol. My father's was an alcoholic, and we played all the roles that one writes and reads about in terms of the alcoholic family. And I think my role would be described hero and taking a lot of responsibility for things. All these years, I've thought we were a normal family. I've begun to look at other families and compare them with our own. We're different. Something's missing. Openness, honesty, feelings. We don't live naturally as they do. We are unpredictable and cautious, unsure of each other. I wish we felt free to hug and laugh, talk, and be ourselves and tell the truth. I wish we knew what it is to be a family. That's retrospective, of course. When you're in it, you don't know how dysfunctional you really are. But the time when it often comes to focus would be a celebration. It would be Christmas time. It would be some big moment. And how disappointingly one discovered those each time. You go in with hopes, and that's part of the child of abuse and the family of alcohol. You have a lot of hopes all the time, built quite a bit on unreality. And then you're let down over and over again. I hate holidays, family gatherings, false calm, meaningless conversation, tense smiles. All the while a thunderhead hovers over everyone, waiting for a word, a gesture, a mysterious mistake to ignite the great explosion, and you will drink again. And of course, the children feel powerless in that setting, and they are quite powerless. So I would watch my grandma slip my dad a 10 and constantly enable the person who wasn't really able to support his family very well. And we all enabled him, and that went on all through his life. As a teenager, I lived in the urban area of Minneapolis, I was active in school, very busy. Enjoying it, I guess. It bothered me that I didn't have any dates, and you know, that's awful important when you're young. It just wasn't happening for me. When I came to doing to my 20-year class reunion, as I came up to that was going to be in the summer. The November before, we were having a lot of trouble with my dad, and I was sort of had begun to dream about this class reunion. I mean, I dreamed about it almost for 2 years ahead. How strange, I thought. But something was cooking, you see. That's the way this particular creative mind works. And in November, it all came together, and these two books, the one on alcoholism called I'm Worried About Your Drinking, and this one for teenagers called Who Will Listen to Me, wrote themselves practically in the space of 6 weeks. The stuff just came out. Well, I'd been in there for years cooking, and the stew came to be. I want to be popular. Lord, if I could wish for anything, I want to be popular. I envy kids who feel confident, who date a lot, who know how to make friends and wear clothes. Sometimes my envy is near hate. I despise their success. Lord, I wonder if I really hate myself, not them. I'm disappointed in the way things are. I'm not sure I can or should change. I feel self-conscious and selfish. I have to learn somehow to wait. Someday I may find my own success, not dates and clothes, but good feelings about life, helping and giving, real love rather than popularity. These are hard times, though. Waiting isn't easy. Help me. Yes, it takes a while before we can get that kind of perspective, and as adults, we forget what a struggle it is to be young and to have all of that on your mind all the time. And I kind of notice it lately in young teenage boys. I kind of understand what girls are going through because I was one of them, but the struggle some of these boys at about 13 are having is just awful, and they're in another world. And we've talked, I'm living in a chalet with a family that has two teenage girls right now, and they were apologizing to me for the fact that the girls are sleeping most of the day and then up late at night. And it just took me back 4 years when I was here with my son and his friend. This was my younger son. At 16, slept, same thing, slept all day, listened to tapes all afternoon, wouldn't come to sessions most of the time, and then would be up late at night. Drove me nuts. And I felt really apologetic about this child, you know, and all. I'm just so glad it's just normal. And I'm so glad it's just over. Riding home from a debate tournament once in Duluth, Minnesota, down to Minneapolis, we must have been complaining a lot in the back seat of the car because suddenly the mother and dad who were driving, the mother turned around from the front seat and she said, "Oh, kids, these are the best years of your life." And I thought, is that all there is? I sure get tired of adults saying, "Oh, how nice it must be to be young." I don't think being young is so great. It seems to me everything's mixed up. Just when I feel good about school, I mess up a test. Or I have to change classes. I get excited about sports, and then I forget about curfews. I want to work, but I'm told I'm too young. I feel goofy, and I'm told to act my age. My friends are really important to me, but we let each other down, too. My parents are great 1 week, and the next week they crack down. Being this age is confusing. I don't know why adults think I'm so carefree. I'm not. In fact, I'd rather have more responsibility, like they do, but I can't decide what I want to do. I wish I didn't have to think about it. I hope I get through this stage pretty soon. Stay with me, okay? And I think kids really know that, and I do think they're thinking all the time. It isn't so apparent to us what's going on, but I think inside they are really churning. And I can recall being in about eighth grade, standing at the screen door in the little small town where one of my grandmothers lived, looking out that door, and just I was in another world. I was really detached, in a sense, and wondering what the meaning of life was, while Rosemary Clooney sang Jambalaya or something. I finished high school and went right on to the University of Minnesota, living at home at the time. Mother had died my freshman year in college, and so I really felt obligated to be there then. And I had a sister who was 4 years younger and a brother who was 6 years younger than I. And this was an age when perhaps I began to be introspective. Maybe I've always been that way. Maybe you are too. And begin to sort, when there's a time when we begin to understand ourselves, be able to stand apart from ourselves a little bit and see how we behave in relationship to others. Hate, this is called. Strong word, hate. It doesn't belong to me, not to me. I dislike or feel annoyed. I move to feel disagreement, disappointment, irritation. Hate's too strong for me. I know I'm hiding from the truth. If I have strength enough to love, I also know the power of hate. Call it by another name, yet it is me, weakness. You knew. You know, Lord, and ask me not to run away or deny. You ask only that I confess and begin again. You forgive me. They told me when I was at the university that women don't get to teach social studies in the schools, and history and those kinds of things that I really loved, political science. That if I was a woman in teaching, and what other choices did I have, really? I didn't like nursing. and I wasn't ready to get married. If I was going to teach, I'd better teach elementary school. This midway through my second year. And so I did. I switched over to elementary education, which has served me well in raising a family and teaching in many situations. I did only teach 4 years. But I have thought that that woman gave me bad advice. But it was true. The coaches all taught social studies. And so there probably would have been no place for me in the end. And at that point also, I was a member of a church where I had an opportunity once to preach on a Sunday evening worship experience called Fellowship for All. And I was able to talk about my experience with my mother dying. And I thought, this feels really good to me. And I had, since I was 10, been asking the question, why? Why is life like this, God? I was really asking the big questions early, I guess, about suffering and things. And it seemed to me that I maybe would want to go into something in the ministry, but there were no women pastors, so I didn't even think of that. That never came to my mind. But missionary came to mind, and I thought, no, my parents discouraged that. That would too hard a life, they said. And parish worker didn't fit for me, neither did secretarial work in the church, and so I abandoned the notion of going to work for the church and, as I say, went to the university. Got out and taught for a while, and about a year after I graduated, married a man who I had known for just that 1 year, who was a pastor, interestingly enough. And we spent our first year in Hartford, Connecticut, and then back to Minnesota, where we've been all the rest of that time. My writing didn't really start until about then. And this book called Beginnings is about the first year of marriage, but I wrote it about 15 years later. And I like to show it to you a little bit because it has photographs in it. And I honestly think these photographs are what make the book. Can you tell from where you are that that's a picture of a fern? Or two of them, really. And each of those little, do we call those fronds? Mm-hmm. See how this fits with the text. Life is filled with routine, repetition, and familiarity. Spring's budding trees bring the wonder of change. We rejoice in newness. You are my spring, my hope for refreshment. This is God's blessing on us, that together we hope for a better world, a world of fresh beginnings. And this is a book which takes a couple through a first year, through the pain as well as the joys of it, the delight of it. I can remember one image in here is of a barbed wire fence having to do with that first terrible fight. As I was about, as my first child was born, we were struggling a lot with my dad again, and that's when I began to write poetry. No, I'd written it when I was in third and fourth grade, but it all rhymed then. And my son was in about fourth grade, the youngest one, who now wants to be a writer himself, he used to say, Mother, this isn't poetry you write. It doesn't rhyme. But by the time that Ted was being born, and you saw Ted last night balancing a ladder on his chin, I think he might have good hook on his chin. By the time he was being born, some of those pressures really began to come out in poetry. And I really think that's what it is for me. It's a catharsis, it's a therapy to be able to put things down on paper. And I was fortunate that the first time I ever submitted anything to a publisher, they said, we like this idea and we'd like to make a book. That doesn't happen, I don't know, once in how many times. That was a real miracle for my life because I would never, I believe, have tried again had it not happened the first time for me. I would have given up probably. My self-esteem was not high enough. But that was like, you know, have you ever watched a faucet get thrown off by the water and it just comes shooting out? Well, that's what happened to me when that first book came out. So the first three books had a lot to do with being a parent of very young boys, very young, active boys. And the question came to me, will I still know my husband? Sometimes mothers become buffers. We try to help fathers understand why teenage sons want long hair. We attempt to demonstrate to children the respect and understanding their fathers need. Lord, give me direction or I will become a peacemaker with no identity or conviction, absorbing conflicts like paper towels and smoothing rough waters. I must look ahead. 5, 10, 15 years from now, I will be less a buffer and more a wife. My husband must be my primary relationship. It's so hard, Lord, because children and smoothing and interpreting take so much time. Often husbands get less time. Sometimes we think of husbands as fathers more than as mates. When I'm living in a home empty of children, will I still know my husband, who he is? Help me realize that even though my husband does not grow taller, he is still growing and his needs change too. Help me to seek to know him as much as I observe and acknowledge the growing and changing of my children. Let me not get so involved in mediation that I lose sight of the relationship on which this family was initially built. My marriage will outlive my mothering role. If you've parented, then you know that between 4 and 6 is just a terrible time of day, or it can be. Well, we find it here, don't we, in the village. Sometimes it's around 7 or 8, just before they need to go to bed, but that time just before dinner when kids are hungry is really tough. And I can remember Ted standing at the bottom of the stairs, playing in the basement, screaming orders up at me at the top of the stairs, just yelling at me. And I could feel that shot of anger go through me, you know, that I thought I would just explode. And the history of a family that was not dysfunctional, kept me from saying anything. And I realized, you know, it isn't that he's really angry. It's that he's hungry. And he doesn't know that. He doesn't know how to put those things together. And so I need to be more patient with him at that time.
Was Ted a child or your husband?
Ted was my child.
I couldn't tell.
Wonderful. Ted was my child, not my husband. And one night as they were watching Sesame Street, wrestling the children in the living room area, which was right adjacent to the kitchen. I had a friend who said that was masochistic to put the play area next to the kitchen. I just turned off the stove and wrote, "Give me earplugs, Lord. The noise of motherhood is just too much sometimes. The television's blaring, the boys are wrestling, or pulling those toys with bells, bells, bells. The exhaust fan is running in the kitchen. Even the frying hamburgers sound noisy. I can't stand it. This is what motherhood can be. Whining children, gadgets that whir and clank and break, a teenager laying rubber at the corner. And the sound of my grating voice repeating the same unheard and usually unnecessary commands over and over in vain hope of obedience. I think I need to get away from it all, Lord. I'd like to take a trip. But I'd be satisfied with a locked bathroom. If someone wouldn't be pounding on the door to tell me his latest adventure or to tattle on a neighbor. Right now, I'd settle for my head in a drawer. That's funny. I can see me with my head in a drawer. Well, if I can laugh, I can survive. I'm sorry I complained, Lord. I'm sure you understand how I feel. Thank goodness you are always listening, and you don't plead for earplugs. A woman came up to me at hearing this one time and said that she had 6 children, which I always thought was about 4 beyond the call of duty. I wanted 4 until I had 2. And she said that she experienced that same thing, just announced to her family she'd had it. She was going in the bathroom. She's going to take a hot bath. For 1 hour, there was nobody who was to speak to her about anything. locked the door, climbed in the tub, and a note came under the door. So we need to laugh. And we need to have perspective. And every once in a while it comes to you, you know. We had a fine hike this afternoon, the boys and two friends and I. I tend to put off those opportunities, making cookies together. It's messy. Hiking, sliding, skating. Well, it's cold and an effort to get ready. Making paper projects, drawing, playing a game with the children. Today was another example of what fun we can have. We chose and discussed and picked interesting weeds. We collected pollution along the way. Oh, the litter everywhere. We had some hot chocolate. We explored a small wooded area, and we talked together about all sorts of things. Even when the wind felt nippy, we were enjoying ourselves. We were entertained, and it was free. We were happy, and afterward we were pleasantly tired. Life is made of memories, of walks and talks, and the sight of two small boys running ahead through an autumn meadow. This is the good life. Thank you, Lord. And so those two little boys became the dedication of this particular book, Life is Good, Life is Hard, with a picture of the two of them in front when they were very young, which you can't see so well. But one a white-skinned blonde and the other a dark-skinned, brown-haired, curly little guy, and as different two personalities as can be. But they did always, when they were young, get along rather well. That was kind of a gift. Ted is this active, almost driven now person with a lot of energy and athletic, capable. When he was a toddler, I wrote a hooded sweatshirt underneath a red umbrella, struts across our lawn saying, "March, march, patriot of a land called childhood." His brother, soft-spoken, inner-thinking, well-grounded human being since he was 3 years old. This child has known who he was and what he was about better than I did. Musician, writer, bless the small boy asleep in the front hall at twilight, in his crumpled jacket with a lunchbox snack beside him, too tired to go another step, play another game, find another acorn, or watch another bird. This little person brought me dried weed flowers and told me, "I love you." It was true. I heard him come in, and then I didn't hear him for a long time afterwards, and I thought, well, where's Michael? And I went to find him, and there he was asleep. He never got past the entrance of the hall. And then, of course, we had that stage, which was just about the time when I was at Holden last, when the children pull away. They have to do that. Part of it, but it's hard. Lord, this is a difficult time. My children are drawing away from me. Daughters no longer tell their secrets. Sons avoid my touching them. When I ask questions, I hear, "Oh, Mom." I feel left out, Lord. I used to sit and listen for what seemed hours to running accounts of a seventh grade class party, a new snow fort, a school play, the cute boy, a basketball scrimmage. Sometimes all I hear these days is, "We just went to a movie, that's all. Hi, Mom, who has the car tonight?" "I'd like to talk, Mom, but I'm going to be late getting to Mark's." I know they must build their own lives, but I miss them. I still need their affection. I still want to share their joys. I still want to be needed. Help me, Lord, to understand when they feel they must work things out alone, to recognize their need to feel independent, to build my life around other things than children's activities and achievements. Help me to endure these years of withdrawing, with patience and without prying, so that someday when they feel independent and trusting, they will again come to me and ask, "Mom, can I talk to you about something?" I still cry when I read that, because it's still off and on. They can come sometimes and other times they can't. I remember talking to Michael his first year in college. He was just in the pits, It was just after Thanksgiving. He was lonely. He was way out in Boston. And we talked and talked and talked. And I listened to him spiral down, you know, lower and lower. And then finally I said, "Oh, Michael, I don't like what you're saying. I'm afraid of what you're saying." And he said, "Mother, I'm not suicidal." And then he talked himself right back out. And one of his statements was, "Well, it's only 1 year out of 80. See how well grounded? The next day, of course, I felt I had to call him and see if he was okay. He'd forgotten about the whole thing. When they were still relatively young, but both in school, I began to work outside the home again because I just needed that for me. And I did some work with radio in the Minneapolis schools. But of course, that changes the family a great deal. "Help, I need a day off. I work at my job, kitchen, in the yard, in the basement, utility room. I never get time off. I'm responsible all the time. And I notice the areas where I slip. Fewer nice dinners. Missing children's sports events. Weeds in the garden. Cobwebs in the den. Part of working outside the home is this sense of unending responsibility. But I may be overreacting today. I have more help from my family than I used to have. My garden isn't perfect, but it's all right. My family hardly has time for big dinners on weekdays anyway. Now that I think of it, the cobwebs were there before I started to work outside the home." "And what's wrong with allowing myself a little free time? To play tennis or read a book. It does me good to relax. I'm sorry, Lord, I expected too much of myself again. I was trying to be self-sufficient, all-powerful, and perfect again. Forgive me." Things have changed. I have changed since I went to work. I was the one who had been happy at home. I still am. I like my family, my home. But I've added something to my life. Confidence. I've tried more new experiences during my first months of working than I had tried for years previous. I had to travel alone. I learned to get around in unfamiliar areas. I developed skill in organization. I have become more quickly sensitive to my children, their health, their quietness, their disappointments. Because I needed to be perceptive, I didn't have time to wait to be told. I'm less self-centered. I appreciate friends and people who help me. I'm grateful for the surge of pleasure and pride that comes when someone says I've accomplished a task at work. These experiences can't be taken away whether I work for years or only for another week. I have grown because I dared to try, dared to fail, and I made it. I altered my life pattern and I made it. Thank you, Lord, for giving me this opportunity to learn more about myself. The cover of this book says it's called Mom Has a Second Job. It's off the market now, but you see this picture? This woman is very nicely dressed for work. Good. And on the table, she has two slices of bread for breakfast and a nice pot for her tea and a teacup and fresh flowers and her Bible. This is before she goes to work. This cover is very unrealistic. The German cover for that book, they published it in Germany, has a woman with a phone held up to her ear, looking, her hair kind of in disarray, looking almost harried. And I think, I bet that book sold better in Germany. In spite of my hopes otherwise, my marriage was disintegrating from a very early time. So that all the time that I was writing everything you've heard so far, most of the time, I was really struggling with keeping that marriage together. And it was very difficult. And I dare say we were just two nice people, you know, and we were good parents. We knew how to do that. There was no way that I would have broken a home when those kids were small. I don't even like the term broken. So I was in counseling from at least the second year on of our marriage, always trying to fix myself. Not very successful. And at times trying to fix the marriage, but making no progress. Finally, when the boys were about 13 to 15, it became apparent to me that we had to do something very serious, or we would never make it. It was, no matter what I'd been doing, it was always when I began to drive back home that my jaw clenched tight. I carried the weight of our relationship clutched in my head, my chest, and my arms. Finally, my teeth began to ache, and my stomach couldn't welcome food. I hurt. My whole body hurt from the tension of trying and trying and trying. My body knew it couldn't be done. And so in 1980, we went into some real serious marriage counseling. We came to Holden for the first time in 1980. Spent some days apart. I came first with the boys, and John came a little later because he couldn't really get off work. And continued with that counseling until April of 81 when we separated. We promised a covenant in church for better, worse, richer, poorer, sickness, health, until death. We broke the promise. Yet being together was death for both of us. We were no longer healthy. Today we have another chance to live again. Still, it's hard to break a promise. And that is especially true when you're a pastor's family. We felt so much responsibility for leadership and example. And for those boys, one of the worst days I can remember is telling those boys that we were going to be divorced. And having Ted, and they reacted just so predictably. Ted was so mad at us right away. And then, not long afterwards, Ted said, when Dad moved away, then he wanted to sit in Dad's spot at the table. And I told him, no, he couldn't do that. Because, you see, he was going to be responsible, older children. Michael was the one who left the house quietly and sat under the tree for a long time and didn't tell his friends for a long time. And that night he suggested that he and Ted might move out for a while so that Dad and I could try to work it out, taking the classic responsibility for the breakup of the marriage, which so many children do. I look back on all those things with great pain. And I still would say that I don't regret making the decision, because I think it was the right decision, but it was hard. And one experiences many different things, and that's what this book called Divorce is about, all kinds of things, and I just randomly selected this one. I can tell by the way they say single, people feel sorry for me. Some of them promise, you'll find someone again. Others tease, have you met any nice person yet? It's implicit in their words the idea that marriage is better and single is less than. It makes me wonder how always single people feel in a coupled society. I wonder how much the expectations of people having to be married influenced my decision to marry and confused my thoughts on divorce. I'm still a whole person. I still like basketball and reading and snow and dinners out and children, sunshine, and my work. I'm not less than. I'm me. Single is not inadequate. It's like all of life, bittersweet and good and rich and full of God. Sadness, promise, fear, they're all there. People need not feel sorry for me. One of the things that really developed in my lifetime here at Holden was that sense of ecology, that sense of oneness with the rest of the created world. By the way, would you like to just stretch a little? You need that, because it's hard to sit still. Stand, sure stand. I old bad back me, welcome that. There are times in the middle of this, you know, when I feel like all I'm doing is talking about myself. Just feels real self-centered. And so, from that experience with Holden, came this book called Help Me Adapt, Lord, that describes how one could live happily with less. It's been a throwaway world. Disposable diapers, tableware, cups, shavers, dressing gowns, pop cans, bed pans, tissues, cast-offs creating landfills, landfills of luxury. Soon it became pervasive cast-off people, disposable values, replaceable nature. Shall we yet throw away all that is dear? Or will we cling to lasting, life-giving values, people, love, sharing, earth, God? We'll be talking more about that on Saturday. And a lot of families experience this, and so I just chose this one. Oh, I wish we could move. Our house seems crowded. When we bought it, I remember thinking it was an adequate house, one to last a lifetime. It is. A nice, pleasant home. But I guess deep down I thought if we wanted to, we could move someday. We can't. Look around me. Make a list. Warm room, rooms and floor, ample furniture, a nice yard, close to transportation, walk to church, to stores, a nice, pleasant home. Add a touch of color, some plants, some fresh paint, rearranging, reupholstering, gratitude. Deep down, I'm glad to have a nice, pleasant home. In fact, it was interesting because I wrote that because of something someone else had said and showed it to her, and they chose not to move. That made me feel kind of good. Wealth is other people, with enough to spare, to spread around. I will not claim wealth. It requires responsibility, like sharing, giving, gratitude, satisfaction. I prefer striving, increasing, gaining, reaching for more, claiming I'm still so far behind the others. Today, I shall pile upon my camel all my possessions, gifts, and talents, and count them one by one. Will my camel fit into the needle's eye? You'll know how timely this one is, written some time ago. Aging is for other people. Except now and then when I can't run the stairs or climb the hill to my chalet. Gray hairs bother me, but I feel just like I did when I was young. I feel 20. I have to feel young. There isn't an ad on television that doesn't suggest I should be young. If I admit I'm aging, then I must acknowledge I'm dying. I'm dying someday, but not yet, Lord, not so soon. I'd rather pretend I'll be young forever. Help me be more honest. Life is the good gift, and aging is the process of living. I think I'll put that on my wall, my mirror. So as we have moved now through a lot of years, it seems to me we come back to this basic premise that life is good, life is hard. And as I summarize what I've been talking about, I'll use this book because it's the newest. I thought it should be titled Life is Hard, Life is Good. Because that's, I think, how we come to understand that. Life is hard, but life is good. But my editor disagreed with me. We've had these disagreements over the years. On the cover of the book for mothers, I wanted to put dandelions, a bouquet of dandelions, because mothers know that's the first one you ever get that really means something, that wonderful little bouquet. And he said, Dandelions. When I think of dandelions, I think of them all over my front yard. I can't stand them. Well, I'll show you the cover. Buttercups and clover. No dandelions, you notice. So you know who's in charge.
The editor
is in charge. The he editor, right? The dandelions show up on the first page with the first poem. So it is with titles from time to time, and the editor said, and I don't know, he's smarter than I am in a lot of things, so maybe this is right, that people want to know that this is a positive book first, and so you tell them that life is good, and then you put life is hard. See, and I don't agree, but that doesn't matter. That's what it's called. Life is good, life is hard. But life isn't fair. She was snatched away without warning or illness, 27, beautiful and vibrant with life. The graveside mourners could not bear to leave. Her husband speechless, her family distraught, and all around them silence and tears. Silence. It is not fair, and there are no answers to why. It is God's will we should live and be happy and take care of each other. Yet again and again we discover we are only humans. People are hurt and they die even at 27. Life is not fair. Our only comfort? God weeps with us and welcomes her home. Take care of each other. Life isn't fair. She was one of my first funerals. I went into ministry after the divorce. Over a short period of time, any number of people who were important to me, said, you know, you ought to be a pastor. Now, I'd never really thought about it since those early years, you recall. Didn't really think about it, and then this idea kept being planted, and I sensed that I ought to check that out. It was, in a sense, a calling, and yet I had so many doubts. I am just a professional doubter. A lot of questions, and so I went to the seminary to see if I could ask those questions. And I could, and nobody blanched. They just listened and heard me out and gave me some perspective and didn't insist that my faith fall into some kind of a prescribed pattern. And that was so wonderful for me. It was so life-giving. And that's why I was able to stay there and pursue that, because doing the ministry seemed pretty natural. That seemed right, but I wanted to be sure I had the faith. And of course, I discovered that I do and I don't. Life is good, but life is hard. This is called separation. I wait so long to have it over with, and then it's over with, and I cannot bring him back. And the sobs which fill the room, the cries, the pain, empty my body from the very back of my being, rise above the mountains into the distance, longing to pull him back, to see the smile, to reach for the comfort and plead, don't go, only to know he cannot stay, even when his tears say he wants to. This is the pain of love and separation that Jesus knew, pleading to stay, having to go, knowing the Father of mountains watches it all with us and holds us, crying with us, because it must be so if we could call it love at all. I delivered Ted to Oberlin College his freshman year and wrote this, I think, driving. I used to do that when they were younger, and I sort of got over it. When they were younger, you know, you had to write when you had a chance, alone in the car or... But I should have stopped, you know, or on a highway, or at night, middle of the night. John used to say he could hear the pencil going in the middle of the night, you know. As I got older, and they got older, of course, it was possible to find more time. The child in arms grown tall and lean is ready to begin to live adult. We are pulled taut between holding on and letting go. The joy of vicarious achievement and the pain of realizing that life is short and nothing ever stays the same. The promise of their future gleams in our tears of loss. Only God stays the same. human beings weep to say goodbye. It happened for Ted, and then it happened for Michael. I remember sitting with Mike. He went on the plane, and we had some time before he was to leave, and we sat on the couch. Well, we were separated from each other first. He was on the couch, I was in the chair. And I said, well, Michael, I think you're really ready for this now. He's on scholarship at Harvard. I think you're really ready for this now, but I said, I'm going to really miss you. You know, and of course, I couldn't even get the words out before I started to cry. And then he started to cry. So then I went over and sat next to him, and he put his arm around me, and we sat and cried and cried. And finally, I said, well, we can't cry like this for an hour. Well, he said it wouldn't be the first time. Yeah, he's always been that way, you know. He's that gift to me. And then, of course, you know, we called home at Thanksgiving and in a lot of pain. So I thought that this would be the great adjustment for me, to have these boys out of the house. Now I had my profession, but I'd always been a mother for so long, and I loved being a mom. And was I going to be okay? I got used to it in about a month. I grieved for at least a year ahead. I kind of do that in anticipation. And then I kind of adapted rather well. And they came home at Christmas, Ted with Catherine, who sang last night a protest song. And Michael loved coming home and hated going back. We cried again the day he went back. The next day I got a call from Oberlin. It was the 11th of January, 1988. And the doctor said, we have some concern about Ted. He's had night sweats. And I knew that in the fall, and they had given him antibiotics. And he was awful fatigued, but of course he was a junior in college. And she said, but we took an x-ray today, and we found a large mass in his chest about the size of a softball, which just, you know, paralyzed me at the phone in my office. And he was home by 7, and Catherine right behind him she was in Michigan at the time, 7:02 she arrived. And then we went through biopsies and tests, and Ted had Hodgkin's disease, which, you know, will tie right back to the fact that my mother had Hodgkin's disease. And again, I was just struck, but with fear. Plus, we had discovered with each of them it had been diagnosed the same week of the same month, 30 years apart. There was something very eerie and frightening about that. I was very depressed last year through that winter. Mother had died in May, and they told me Ted would not only live, he would be well. But it was very hard for my stomach to believe that, even if my head did want to. And so we went through chemotherapy with Ted last year. Catherine lived with us during that time. She was wonderful for him. She understood and encouraged him in meditation and reflection. And Ted has lived to say that he was grateful to have Hodgkin's disease, something only he can say. I'm not grateful, even yet. But he said, no, don't say that, Mother. I'm grateful because I would never have discovered meditation and reflection without it. So he's well now. And the whole thing about adjusting to have, the irony of being so worried about living alone and then having two people in the house, one of them desperately sick half the time and irritable and unpleasant, you know, it was an unpleasant time, and the other one a stranger who's going to be my daughter-in-law maybe someday, and learning to live together. Last year was really an interesting year. And when they left, I was just glad to clear everybody out of the house and just have me and the dog. But I learned again, and with two last poems, some very important things. I learned this maybe most during the divorce, and then last year as well. And this is called Friendly Protection. Do not gather in all your pain and hide it in a box, putting it away on a shelf. For pain will always steal away in the middle of the night and come to haunt you. Rather, tell your friends that you have pain. And tell your pain that you have friends. Name the agony and tell it how you hate it until you are too weary to say any more. Then set it aside on a shelf. It may steal out someday, but it will not haunt you, because you have friends who know and understand. And although it took for me last year some antidepressants for a while, and just living through it and protesting against it, I was very angry with God and life. I said it was not my turn that I should potentially lose a child. I was scared that I would give up on life. But we live through it because of other people, I think, because of God and other people. So that I could write, "Life is hard, but life is good." Today I believe in people. I believe in a doctor who cries and in friends who wait. And people sing to themselves even when they're alone. I believe that black nights calm a tired traveler and embrace lovers. That a small boy can belong to all mothers and love any homeless dog. I believe that sunlight dances on the floor of anguish and warms the toes of those who long for the touch of smiles. I believe in people, in good. I believe in life. Life is hard, but life is good. Take care of each other, and God bless you.